cities are going to have to scramble pretty fast here to change their laws and the way parking violations are treated.
The unintended consequences of well-meaning legislation. From the Alaska Public Radio Network, this is Alaska News Nightly for Tuesday, April 23rd. Good evening, I'm Lori Townsend. Also tonight, the Alaska delegation has another go at renaming Mount McKinley.
President McKinley was an Ohioan, so we may have to work with Senator Portman to make sure that President McKinley continues to receive the kind of respect and attention that he deserves.
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Today's broadcast of Alaska News Nightly is presented by
the Pebble Partnership, developing a comprehensive mine plan that meets Alaska's regulatory requirements while supporting sustainable fisheries in Southwest Alaska. PebblePartnership.com. The School of Management at the University of Alaska Southeast has accounting degrees online to prepare students with the skills required by Alaska's industries. Learn more at uas.alaska.edu. This message sponsored by University of Alaska Southeast.
Shell Oil had to postpone its Arctic drilling for a full year after one of its oil rigs ran aground off the Alaska coast this winter. But Shell's efforts to open a new frontier of oil exploration in the Arctic Ocean continues with work conducted in Puget Sound. The oil giant passed a key test with federal regulators last month in the waters off Anacortes, Washington. John Ryan reports from Seattle Public Radio Station KUOW.
It took several tries, and neither Shell nor the federal government announced the results, but a contractor successfully deployed Shell's Arctic oil spill containment system last month in Samish Bay. Crews from Superior Energy Services lowered a steel dome over the side of Shell's Arctic Challenger barge. They anchored the dome in 150 feet of water and successfully sucked up seawater at a rate of about 2,000 gallons a minute. That's what the dome's supposed to do if a blown-out well gushes oil and gas from the bottom of the Arctic Ocean. Earlier tests of the containment dome had gone badly. In September, the 20-foot dome wound up crushed like a beer can. In an email, Nicholas Pardee with the Federal Bureau of Safety and Environmental Enforcement said the spill system handled more than twice the volume of oil that's expected in a worst-case well blowout. Pardee did not respond to KUOW's requests to interview either of the federal officials who were on board the Arctic Challenger, nor did he provide the requested documentation of the test results. On his first day in office, President Barack Obama issued a memo ordering federal agencies to make his administration the most transparent ever.
The way to make government responsible is to hold it accountable. And the way to make government accountable is to make it transparent so that the American people can know exactly what decisions are being made, how they're being made, and whether their interests are being well served.
But journalists and open government advocates complain that many agencies, from the EPA to the FDA, didn't seem to get the memo. It can be difficult or impossible to get many Obama administration officials to answer questions. Curtis Smith of Shell Alaska declined to comment on the successful test of the oil spill system, except to say that Shell has a 10-day information blackout before its quarterly earnings reports. I'm John Ryan in Seattle.
While things like oil taxes and education funding may get the most news coverage, every year the legislature passes plenty of bills that amount to housekeeping. Mostly they do unexciting things like cleaning up administrative code, but sometimes they lead to more interesting results, such as parking ticket holidays in cities across the state. APRN's Alexandra Gutierrez explains.
This is a story of unintended consequences. When the legislature took up a bill standardizing police officer paperwork 3 years back,
they were not thinking about parking tickets.
Jesse Keel serves on the Juneau Assembly, and he is thinking a lot about parking tickets these days. That's because the bill requires police officers to personally serve citations, as in directly hand them to you. The idea is that you want officers to get the right guys when they issue tickets for things like speeding or underage drinking. But as of this month, the court system won't hear any case where an officer stuck a ticket under someone's windshield wiper. That's a problem for cities like Juneau that let the courts handle parking ticket appeals.
The concern that I think not just Juneau, but a whole lot of communities are going to have is that if a police officer or a parking officer, a meter reader, has to write a parking ticket, either they need to wait around for the vehicle owner to come back, or cities are going to have to scramble pretty fast here to change their laws and the way parking violations are treated.
For a city to keep leaving parking tickets on cars, they're going to have to switch to a system like the one that Anchorage has, where a person has to go before a municipal parking authority instead of a magistrate to contest their ticket. There isn't a way to get an exception to the personal service statute because a court order clarifying the matter went into effect a day after the legislature gaveled out. Lawmakers aren't scheduled to come back until January.
I think it's fair to say that a whole lot of cities have been caught by surprise. I had a conversation with someone at the court system today who said that a whole lot of cities weren't aware that this change was coming.
So if this bill passed 3 years ago, how did we get to this point now? One city attorney described it to me as one of those bureaucratic nightmare sort of things where stuff just falls through the cracks. Representative Mike Hawker, a Republican from Eagle River, carried the measure on behalf of the Department of Public Safety. He says his office wasn't all that involved in the drafting of the legislation and that it didn't spark any controversy. Nobody suggested that it would require cities to rewrite their parking ordinances.
You know, I don't recall any anticipated problem there. I mean, you know, bills like that get heard. We've got a lot of good people in the legislature that look at them, but it appears that there was an unintended consequence of the language that was inside that bill.
Hawker wonders why cities didn't register their concern over the law earlier. The court system had a long review period before making their rules official. Nancy Mead, who serves as a court system's general counsel, says that notice of the rules change was sent on three separate occasions to police chiefs and city officials, along with every lawyer in the state.
It depends on how closely they read the emails, and I just don't know, but apparently some missed it.
With no easy fixes, places like Seward, Valdez, and Sitka, just to name a few more cities, are in parking limbo until they change their laws to treat tickets as a civil fine, if they even want to do that. Kenai is worried they're going to have to raise their ticket fees if they have to dedicate city staff time to handling appeals, and they'll probably have to start towing more cars if they don't have a fix before the summer season. As far as Juneau goes, the city's in a short-term bind. They're already drafting an ordinance that would put the city in charge of parking citations. Until then, Keel says they're in a less than ideal situation, but he's not expecting mass chaos.
The Republic will not fall. People by and large will park and play nice and watch their 2 hours or whatever the rules are. Might some scofflaw take advantage? The possibility is always there. But I think that we'll deal with this as fast as we can, and I'm sure other cities will too.
It'll take a couple of assembly meetings before they can change their system. For now, Keel hopes that people listen to their better angels by feeding their meters, leaving handicapped spots open, and keeping the fire lane clear. In Juneau, I'm Alexandra Gutierrez.
The state reported the first case of rabies in Alaska's interior today. A trapper killed a wolf in the Chandler Lakes area south of the Brooks Range in late March. KUAC's Emily Schwing reports.
Trappers have always faced a risk of exposure to rabies. That risk became a reality when a wolf encountered a trapper in the southern foothills of the Brooks Range back in March. The trapper legally shot the wolf and transported it to the Mat-Su Valley. When he went to skin the animal, he cut himself.
So he contacted his health provider, and they decided to go ahead and have the wolf tested for rabies, and it came up positive.
Bob Gerlach is Alaska's state veterinarian. He says the disease has never before been reported south of the Brooks Range or as far east as Chandler Lake.
But the state had not until 2 years ago started to go ahead and do surveillance of for rabies in actually the wildlife populations.
The state uses a field test called a DRIT test to look for rabies in the field. In the past 2 years, they've collected 1,000 samples. Last summer, the test helped them track down the first case of rabies in a wolverine near Umiat on the North Slope. Most cases of rabies are found among Arctic foxes that live along the western and northern coast of the state. 3% of red foxes trapped in the Bethel area last year tested positive for rabies. Kimberly Beckman is a veterinarian with the Alaska Department of Fish and Game in Fairbanks. She says cases of rabies in wolves are rare.
Seems to me we have a case in a wolf about once every year or two. They don't always make the news, but usually they've attacked a hunter or a trapper or something like that.
Beckman is calling on trappers in the Chandelier and 40 Mile regions to provide ADF&G with tissue samples from the heads of wolves, wolverines, foxes, and coyotes. Fish and Game is also asking for samples from the Mat-Su region because the wolf that tested positive most recently was transported there. But Bob Gerlach says it's not time to start panicking about a rabies outbreak in Alaska.
If there was had been rabies in that area for a time period but never been tested before, then you can say this is the first case we've found in this area, but it's not like rabies is massively spreading. We're definitely not saying that. We're just saying that we found a case in this area where we normally wouldn't expect to go ahead and find it.
The state will continue its surveillance program and expand a program that trains civilians to administer rabies vaccines to dogs, cats, and other domestic animals in rural communities. In Fairbanks, I'm Emily Schwing.
Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, an innovative program to help middle schoolers succeed in engineering and science.
It's all about raising the bar and showing kids that they can do things that they might not necessarily consider.
That's ahead. Stay with us.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by
Crowley. Celebrating 60 years in Alaska, Crowley knows Alaska and uses that experience to deliver project solutions from concept to completion. More at CrowleyAlaska.com.
And by
the law firm of Landy Bennett Blumstein. Attorneys who know the people, businesses, tribes, and communities of Alaska. Landy Bennett Blumstein. Online at LBBLawyers.com.
A subcommittee of the U.S. Senate Energy Committee appears to have no objections to renaming Mount McKinley. Although, as APRN's Peter Granitz reports, we've been here before.
The state of Alaska officially calls the continent's highest peak by the native name Denali. Mount McKinley, which is what the federal government calls the mountain, sits inside Denali National Park. So you can be forgiven if you mix up the names. Peggy Odell is the deputy director for operations at the National Park Service. She says if Congress wants to rename the mountain, go for it. No objections from her agency.
We don't object. If they choose to act, we will happily institute whatever decision they make.
Sailing through Congress won't be easy. This very exercise happened last year, as it has for decades, unsuccessfully. The business meeting of the National Park Subcommittee cruised with few sparks. Colorado Democrat Mark Udall chairs the subcommittee, and as he was winding it down, he recounted that he actually climbed Denali, and he's okay with officially recognizing it as just that.
Senator Portman, I think, hails from, I know he hails from Ohio. I think President McKinley was an Ohioan, so we may have to work with Senator Portman to make sure that President McKinley continues to receive the kind of respect and attention that he deserves. But I think this is a suitable step we could take.
And almost on call, as Udall was saying that, the lone Ohioan on the subcommittee entered the room. Senator Rob Portman hadn't been seen yet, and he almost missed his chance to speak. So the ever-courteous Portman took the microphone, saying he wanted to talk about two of the 14 bills before the committee.
A memorial to commemorate the mission of the Peace Corps here in Washington, D.C., on federal land.
Okay, one down. The next must be about McKinley. Native son of Ohio, 25th president of the U.S., and Ohio's fondness for the Alaska Mountain, officially named for him.
We're also reintroducing a bill to allow a plaque to be placed on the World War II memorial inscribed with the words of Franklin Roosevelt that he prayed with the nation on D-Day.
And that's it. No mention of Denali. For years, the Ohio delegation has routinely defended the Mount McKinley name, successfully. And the Alaska delegation has routinely failed in swaying them to give up that fight. This first move may look like a step in the Denali direction, but because of the numerous fails in the past, it's no sign things will be different this Congress. And if the bill manages to pass the subcommittee, whole committee, and full Senate, it goes to the House, which is led by Speaker John Boehner, who hails from the great state of Ohio. In Washington, D.C., I'm Peter Granitz.
As the Alaska Marine Highway System approaches its 50th anniversary, the ferry is struggling with its identity. Under intense pressure to cut costs, the ferry managers are trying to get back to basics, transporting Alaskans and their freight. That's why the state is trying to phase out wildlife naturalists on all ferry routes. KUCB's Lauren Rosenthal reports.
It takes the Tustavina 3.5 days to sail from Homer to Unalaska. Along the way, passengers will see kittiwakes and puffins, orcas and foxes. The route's part of a national scenic byway, but the volcanic terrain can be foreign for both lifelong Alaskans and visitors passing through from the lower 48. That's why naturalists like Doug Stewart travel on the ferry. Stewart says he's there to provide context for the scenery.
We give a lot of informational programs and cover everything that goes on in the Aleutians from World War II to the, of course, seabirds and marine mammals and cultural issues with the native Unangan people that have populated the Aleutians for 9,000 years.
The Fish and Wildlife Service has employed Stewart as the Tustamina's naturalist for more than a decade, but he won't be on the ferry this summer. The ferry system has given a lot of different reasons for wanting to scale back the program. One is federal budget cuts. Federal money covers the naturalist salaries. Poppy Benson, who administers the program for the Alaska Maritime National Wildlife Refuge in Homer, says money was tight for the program this year, but she managed to scrape it together by asking other refuges to chip in.
Between Eisenbeck National Wildlife Refuge in Cold Bay and Kodiak National Wildlife Refuge in the Alaska Maritime, I came up with enough money to fund a season.
We were surprised to even see that they had funding for an interpreter.
That's Jeremy Woodrow, a spokesman for the Alaska Department of Transportation. He says the state wasn't expecting the refuges to come up with the money with the federal sequester in place. Benson says the wildlife refuges thought it was just a misunderstanding, but it isn't. As Woodrow puts it, the state of Alaska has decided that the space the naturalists take up should be sold to residents instead.
You know, it all comes down to cost, and does it help meet our core mission, and that's to move folks between, you know, point A and B.
On the Tustamina, naturalists get free room and board from the ferry system. For an entire summer, that's about $5,000 worth of support. But Woodrow says it's not just about the price tag. The state isn't convinced that the naturalists bring any business to the ferry system.
From a marketing standpoint, the Marine Highway System doesn't see doesn't see that to have an interpreter on board will help, you know, fill seats more, especially really Tustamina where it's sold out anyways.
Staterooms on the Tustamina are already selling out for the summer run, but according to Stewart, the Tustamina's naturalist, it's not just residents buying those rooms.
Quite a few people ride that ship as tourists. I would say by the time we're out of Kodiak, roughly 50-50 tourists, and then the other 50% a mix of commercial fishermen and residents. So it's a pretty big ridership.
It's gotten bigger in recent years. Frommer's, the famed guidebook, listed the state ferry as one of their top 100 attractions in America for families with kids. One of the big draws, the naturalists. Stewart says he was always a big hit with tourists, but the naturalists weren't all about serving visitors. As the ferry progressed on its trip, Stewart says naturalists made an effort to keep all of the passengers in the loop, even if they were locals.
It's a very interesting area, but without anybody explaining it to the people on board, frankly, don't have a clue what's going on out there, particularly if the weather gets bad. So I think onboard programming and having that information flow from me to the passengers is important.
To replace that, the Department of Transportation is considering adding interpretive displays or interactive exhibits. They aren't sure exactly what they'll look like, and they probably won't be in place in time for the ferry's 50th anniversary this summer. The Alaska Marine Highway System is planning a celebration with community festivals throughout southeast and south central Alaska. Stewart was planning events for southwest Alaska on the Tustamina before he found out the naturalist program was canceled. With no one on board to help the Tustamina celebrate, the anniversary sailings through southwest Alaska might look a lot like the ferry's future in all state waters. And on Alaska, I'm Lauren Rosenthal.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by ConocoPhillips. The easy oil is gone, and getting to the remaining oil will be a challenge that will require the state and the industry to work together. ConocoPhillips, Alaska's oil and gas company. Do you own a business or manage employees? Research shows that employees who feel supported at work with their parenting challenges are more loyal and productive. When you let employees know they can attend a teacher conference, stay at home with a sick child, or adjust their schedule to secure quality child care, you contribute to stronger families. That's Strengthening Families Alaska Style. This message is sponsored by Alaska Children's Trust, THREAD, and Best Beginnings.
Building a computer is child's play, or at least it ought to be. That's the premise behind an innovative concept in science and engineering education. As KSKA's Ellen Lockyer reports, the Matanuska-Susitna Borough School District has partnered with UAA's Alaska Native Science and Engineering Program, or ANSEP, to help middle schoolers achieve future university success.
You should not need a screwdriver.
An instructor calls out directions to a room full of kids who are working to fit tiny components together inside an otherwise empty computer case. Jackson Peters is a Wasilla sixth grader. He seems undaunted by the task at hand.
Yeah, the bottom blue is the motherboard. Then we have the RAMs. Then we have the heater, like, thing that cools it down.
Yeah, the fan.
Yeah, we have the fan, and then we have all the fan wires, and we have the fans all hooked up.
Jackson is one of 54 sixth and seventh graders gathered in the ANSEP common room at UAA. The Mat-Su School District middle schoolers are here to take part in the science and engineering camp ANSEP hosts every year. Dr. Herb Schroeder founded ANSEP about a dozen years ago.
It's all about raising the bar and showing kids that they can do things that they might not necessarily consider.
The camp is actually a 12-day activity. Computer building is only part of it. The students will do some hands-on engineering projects and some hydrology work with the Forest Service to get a broad feeling for what it is like to be a scientist or an engineer. The program is an attempt to boost the flagging numbers of Alaska Native students who are ready for college-level studies. Schroeder is outspoken about how the established education system is letting Alaska Native students down.
40% of our Alaska Native kids never graduate from high school on time. We're spending money in ways that aren't changing that number, and we need to stop this. I call it paying for failure.
The students have taken a short break for snacks and a bit of horsing around, but now it's time to get back to work. Two girls bend their heads over their projects, while an ANSEP instructor calls out encouragement over the room's scratchy wireless sound system.
And when it's done, are you going to be able to use this?
Yeah, hopefully. If not, my ego will be damaged forever.
What's your name?
Alyssa McLean.
And from where?
Palmer, Alaska.
Oh, what grade are you in?
Sixth.
Sixth grade? Is this difficult work for you?
Well, for you.
I don't know how you do it.
I just look at the pictures mostly.
This is the first time the ANSEP Middle School Academy is happening before summer vacation, and it's important because it is also the first time that an entire school district is taking part. Schroeder says in the past, students were selected one or two at a time from a number of rural school districts. Mat-Su School District Superintendent Dr. Dina Paramo says 200 students applied for the program from her district.
And our goal really is to open up doors for these kids and have them challenge us. They are building a computer, and they get to keep that computer. Their skin in the game is that these kids are to take algebra by eighth grade, and just challenging themselves academically to move forward in high school as well to be ready for college.
Schroeder says ANSEP wants to extend its model of introducing math and science challenges to elementary and middle school students to 12 school districts around the state by 2018.
And the most significant thing about the Middle School Academy is that in the nation, 26% of eighth graders graduate with Algebra 1 successfully completed. ANSEP students graduate eighth grade with Algebra 1 completed at a rate of 83%. So we're more than three times better than the national average.
Paramo says the school district's part in the program was helped along by state science, technology, engineering, and math, or STEM funds, and Kinnick tribal funds.
It's just an opportunity that we wanted to offer our kids and being innovative in new programs and hopefully creating a pipeline for these kids to be engineers if they'd like and opening those doors.
Schroeder says he wants 3,000 Alaska Native students in that pipeline by 2020, students from sixth grade to PhD candidates. I'm Ellen Lockyer.
Frank Matumiak was born in Barrow in 1948. His mother was required to move there to attend the Bureau of Indian Affairs schools. Though his family had to conform somewhat to the American education system, he said his childhood was still ruled by the seasons. As part of our series looking at culture in Alaska, APRN's Ann Hillman spoke with Matumiak about what life was like when he was growing up.
We know when to hunt the whale. We know when to hunt the seals, the waterfalls. We know when they come. And we know what to expect the next month because that's where we're going to go. So we're, like the white man said, we're kind of nomadic. because we followed these, we did follow these seasons. Well, I grew up hunting. My parents took us out hunting in early spring before the thaw, and we used to take a boat out to the nearest lake and wait for the edge of the lake to thaw out, and when there was a water surrounding it, then we just go on the with a boat through the edge of the lake till we got to the other side, and then we put the boat on rollers and go ahead and roll it over the tundra to the next lake till summer came around. So we were out there till early May and didn't come home till in September. And at that time we used dogs to pull our boats, and we call it ukamuk. And that's how we went along. Either that, we tie ourselves to the boat and just pull the boat, since we didn't have access to the outboard motors and availability of gasoline at that time. Our whole community just lived by these seasons. We're not like a city or anything. We didn't have none of that, because it didn't have no meaning to us. The outside world had no structure in our lifestyle. So whatever our seasons brought, this is how we lived through everything. And this is what we were taught till today.
Elder Frank Matumiak spoke with Ann Hillman in Barrow last year. He lives at the senior center there. And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. If you missed any of tonight's stories, we're online at alaskapublic.org, and you can follow us on Twitter at APRN. We had reports tonight from John Ryan in Seattle, Emily Schwing in Fairbanks, Lauren Rosenthal in Unalaska, Ellen Lockyer in Anchorage, and Ann Hillman in Barrow. APRN's Alexandra Gutierrez reported from Juneau. Our editor and producer is Annie Feit. Our audio engineer is Dave Waldron. Josh Edge is our web producer. And I'm Lori Townsend. Good night.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible by Doyon Limited, Interior Alaska's regional native corporation, providing oil field services, government contracting, and natural resource development in Alaska and across the nation. Information at doyon.com. Register now for the 2013 Business of Clean Energy in Alaska Conference, May 2nd and 3rd at the Dena Center in Anchorage. This fifth annual conference offers participants an unmatched opportunity to network with national industry experts and learn the latest on policies, programs, and projects in the clean energy industry. Online registration ends on April 26th. More information at www.bceaconference.com or 929-7770. This message sponsored by REAP, your voice for renewable energy.
When you've made the decision to stop smoking, whether you've tried to quit before or it's the very first time, there are free and confidential resources available proven successful in helping you quit for good. Alaska's Tobacco Quit Line offers nicotine replacement therapy, confidential counseling, and support services. Because everyone is different, trained quit coaches will tailor a quit plan just for you. For more information, call 1-800-QUIT-NOW or visit alaskaquitline.com.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.